just making up rules. Who made you Judge Judy and executioner?
And not to worry, we will temper our justice with mercy on the Amy Beth Arquie Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. I think we're going to hang a lot in the justice realm today. How are you? We made it to Tuesday. Whew! Perilous world just got a little more onerous with the airstrikes in Syria. Now there's another group besides ISIS we have to worry about, this Khorasan group, apparently offshoots and loyalists to Osama bin Laden. So some troubles there. We'll see what happens. The president is headed to New York. I think he's there already at the UN, so gridlock alert day for the next few days, in fact, in case you're in the city or venturing there. Don't drive. Public transportation is your best bet, that's for sure. That's always your best bet. Anyway, hey, it's also Banned Books Week. Hey, somebody ban my books. It'll sell better. They'll sell better. We'll talk about that. And we'll celebrate a tribute to Ageless Rockers' milestone birthday. All of that, you on the line, should you be listening live on Tuesday, September 23rd, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. The number's in motion at 347-857-4505. And we're already having some glitches in the system, I see. Our music is not working. That's okay, Trudy. She's working on it. You can also reach out via Twitter at AB Writes. It's starting to buzz on the Twitter feed, so says Aurora. The show today being brought to you in part by Sherwin-Williams. It's time to spruce up for fall. You can save on paint, stains, and other supplies at your local Sherwin-Williams store. And also by the Oak Center for Lifelong Learning. It's never too late to embrace your dreams. Live the life you've always wanted. Details at oakcenterlearning.org. Speaking of living the life you've always wanted or figuring out the life you've always wanted, I'm delighted to welcome our guest to the show today. Martin Preeb is a Chicago beat cop turned author. His second book is Crooked City. It's a book of connected essays which take on the mean streets of Chicago. But years before, really, he was a police officer. He got obsessed with a couple of cases that happened in the 80s and kind of investigated them, put them together, and puts under the microscope the so-called wrongful conviction movement. And he writes like a true detective or maybe gritty detective fiction. So we're happy to have him here. Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Let me talk to you a little bit about your own path, though, because it's fascinating to me. You talk early in the book about your love for literature and writing, and I think you wanted to be a college professor early on, and you gravitated towards Chicago, which you lived in Michigan, so you would visit Chicago and got involved with the stories and the writers that were influenced by that city. And then, like a lot of people who after college, especially liberal arts graduates, kind of kicked around, did a bunch of different type jobs, doorman, bartender, that sort of thing. At what point did you decide you wanted to go to the police academy and become a cop?
Well, I just sort of wandered into it. When I was a doorman, I met a lot of beat cops, and a couple of them encouraged me to do it. And until they had mentioned it, I'd never really thought about it. So, you know, I needed a job with a good pension, and I was tired of working crummy service jobs trying to pay my bills, so I just sort of like gave it a try, you know. And before I knew it, I was slowly being hired, going through the process.
Yeah. That's a pretty steep kind of, you know, you kind of sound casual about it, right? Because that's a pretty big step to become a cop. That's a pretty intense kind of career. It's a tough job. Were you concerned about your safety? Were you concerned about what it would be like? Because it's a little different than being a doorman, I would think, or a bartender.
Not really. You know, when I was in the hotels, I fought in the union battles. Chicago was involved in a long battle with the hotel employees union. And, I liked the idea of a job where you wandered around the city. And, you know, I wasn't really gung-ho to become a cop. I thought, well, I'll check it out and go into the academy and see what it's like. And, I just, you know, sort of wandered into it. My whole life I've just wandered into things, so this is kind of an extension of it.
Okay. Sometimes wandering in is a good thing. So did you like it? So you liked it enough from the academy to go on and do it and hit the streets, and you kind of embraced it. And did you like it, or was it just sort of a day-to-day thing? I mean, you accrued some stories. You got some material to write about, that's for sure, but did you like the day-to-day of it?
Some things I liked, some things I didn't like. I found that it was very good for my imagination. You know, it kept me. I liked the idea of working at home alone in the morning, writing, and then going outside and wandering around in the afternoon. And that sort of dichotomy is always seem to work well for me, but it is a tough job and it's a stressful job and, you know, it can really get to you sometimes, but by and large, I think it served me well.
I like the
fact that it makes you look at the world the way it is.
Yeah. Well, you have that gritty realism in your writing for sure. Now, talk about these stories that you became, or these cases that were old cases by the time you hit the streets, that you became obsessed with. How did you get involved with these cases, and what made you start obsessing about the fact that you thought it was, you know, justice didn't work out in these two particular cases that you highlight?
Well, I mean, there was a big change in my mindset when I became a cop, and I saw, you know, I worked in areas that I'd never been in before, and it has a profound impact on your imagination. And I wandered into this case about a guy who murdered a woman in 2006. She was a manager of a Burger King out in the suburbs. And after they caught him and they looked at his past, they saw that he had been convicted of murdering four people in 1982, a family of four. One of the victims was a three-year-old boy he raped first. And I saw that, and I remembered that I came back to Chicago in 1982, right around the same month these murders occurred. And I imagined myself, you know, when I was in college reading literature, how distant I was from an event like this. And how, as I became a cop, I became more and more tied to crime and brutal crimes. And this guy had been convicted of murdering these four people, but he had been released because his case had been, he had appealed the case and won. And they cited police misconduct in the case. And I kept reading about it in the papers, and I couldn't see where the police misconduct was. And so it wouldn't leave me alone. And it was in a period when there were a lot of cases in Chicago where they said the police coerced a confession from people or beat a confession out of somebody. And I just couldn't see where it happened in this case. I couldn't see where the detectives did anything wrong. So it became an obsession of mine, and I started researching it. And as I did, I got to know several people who were working on one of the biggest wrongful conviction cases in the country's history, is Anthony Porter, who was exonerated of a double homicide that took place in 1982. In fact, I think Anthony Porter and this murderer of the four people were in the county at the same time, the county jail. And as I read this Anthony Porter case, it became very clear to me that he was guilty, and there was very little doubt that he was guilty, and that a great injustice had taken place in his exoneration. And
how was he exonerated? He was exonerated through help from the Innocence Project, is that right? And there was some new evidence that came to the fore, or was it also police intimidation in his case?
They claimed that the detectives in the case coerced witnesses in the case, but he was exonerated through the efforts of Northwestern University's Innocence Project, and they claimed that there were pieces of evidence and witnesses who said that somebody else committed the murders, a man named L. Story Simon, who is still actually in prison, and he might get out in the next few months, depending on how the county prosecutor rules on it. She's reviewing the case right now. But once you peeled away the layers of these claims by the Innocence Project, you saw very clearly that there wasn't much there at all, and that some very dark and sinister things had taken place in the case. And there was no evidence. There's really no witnesses who put L. Story Simon at the case. They all put Anthony Porter at the case. And in the course of researching the book, you know, I heard all these claims that, you know, he was innocent, he was guilty. There were all these legal proceedings. It was tough to sort through it. So I tracked down the original detectives on the case, and I got to know them, and they spelled out their investigation. And once they spelled out their investigation, it became all too clear that Porter was overwhelmingly guilty of these murders, and that a great travesty had been foisted upon the criminal justice system. So I couldn't resist writing about it.
So actually, in your telling it, there's a double travesty, because you have this guy who you believe actually was guilty, was convicted, then was set free, and now they also have another guy who they railroaded into prison, according to you, who's now in prison,
yes,
who didn't do it.
Exactly. And the great irony of this whole Anthony Porter case is that the wrongful conviction activists are guilty of one of the worst wrongful conviction cases in the state's history. This Porter case had a profound influence on the state of Illinois. It was the impetus to end the death penalty, and it initiated a slew of other claims by inmates who said, you know, made the same claims and were also exonerated, many of whom I believe are also guilty in these other cases. So the Anthony Porter case is sort of a window into a whole other world that's never been addressed by the journalists or the writers. And the newspapers in town are very disturbed about it because they cheerleaded this exoneration, and they wrote extensively about it. And it's clear that the journalists never even bothered to do a bit of investigation or to ask any questions. One of the most compelling things about this whole case is that after Anthony Porter got out, he sued the detectives, which is in the next step once they get out is they try and get millions of dollars saying they were wrongfully convicted.
Right.
And the two detectives in the case were so passionate about the fact that he was guilty that they went to the city attorneys and said, you can't settle this case. You have to go to trial. And the city attorneys were waffling, and they passed the case on to an outside attorney whose father had been a cop. And he originally thought that Porter was innocent because there was so much news coverage. Well, they went to his office, and they demanded, it got pretty heated, they demanded that he come back to the crime scene and he review the evidence and the documents. And they walked him through the crime, and they showed him that the only person who could have committed this crime was Anthony Porter. And so the attorney said, we're not going to settle. And he went to civil court in 2005. And rather than argue that the cops simply didn't do anything wrong, he turned around and argued that Anthony Porter committed the murder, even though he'd been exonerated. And he won. And Porter never got a dime. And in this
he's still out. He's still free. Wow. Now, what's the reaction in the justice circles in Chicago to your book? I'm sure some people have read it by now.
As you would imagine, the detectives love it because, a lot of Chicago detectives have been saying for decades that these wrongful conviction claims are a big scam. And so the detectives have done it. The media is anybody who's come forward to point out the evidence in the Porter case has been vilified by the local media because there's a very dangerous connection between the wrongful conviction movement and a lot of journalists in the city. And, the Chicago Tribune won a Pulitzer Prize in part for their coverage of the Porter case. So how does it look for a major...
They have a stake in it like prosecutors do. When prosecutors get it wrong and somebody really is innocent, they never want to go back and look at the evidence to get them out, which is also a sin and a crime in and of itself. But you're saying the other thing also applies. If you've taken a stance, whether you're a prosecutor or a journalist, you don't want to be wrong, so you don't want to go back on it even if new evidence emerges or the truth comes
out, which
is a shame.
That's true, but I wouldn't say that connection between as a prosecutors as does a journalist is the same because an accused person has many, many rights to an appeal that a prosecutor has to address whether he wants to or not. He has to go back.
But they can drag their feet because I know there was one case up in Westchester County where I am some years ago when Jeanine Pirro was then the DA, and there was a young man who had wrongfully confessed to a crime when he was 17, pressured into a rape, and he was in prison for 17 years. The Deskovic case, I don't know if you're familiar with it, and somebody else finally confessed to it. He was eventually exonerated after she left office, and the next DA came in to see and resurrected new evidence. But Pirro, who wasn't even a prosecutor at the time that he was convicted, wasn't the DA anyway. She might have been a prosecutor if she wasn't the DA, refused to reopen it, and he languished for a few more years, and I think that's unconscionable. If you see there's evidence to at least examine it and bring it to the fore, don't just let it linger if somebody is possibly wrongfully convicted, because that's not fair. That's an injustice, too. So I think there is pressure. They just feel like, well, it's already been convicted. We've done that case. It's over. And once they exhaust the appeals, and I guess, you know, at this point it was a new round, they try to drag their feet on it, which I don't think is particularly in keeping with what their job is, which is not just to convict, but to convict the right person, you know, to be the shepherd
I'm not
or the steward for justice, I think.
I'm not familiar with the case, but
sure.
So I couldn't comment on it. But
right.
Chicago,
I'm not expecting you to comment on that case. Yeah. Go ahead.
The media, you know, refuse. The media is not obligated through any legal proceedings to, you know, address the evidence.
Sure.
So they've just wholeheartedly ignored and vilified the people who have brought the evidence forth in the Porter case.
Right. But what they could do. No, but I was just going to say, what they could do is reopen it on their own end in terms of investigating it and reporting on it if they so chose. They don't choose, according to you, because they have a stake in it. They have a stake in being right about it the first time, you know, like you said.
That's true. The journalists in Chicago have moved from, you know, journalism to advocacy, and they're now realizing that they were advocating for the wrong position. And, you know, not only was Simon wrongfully, you know, he's been in prison for 14, 15 years now. The detectives, the two detectives in this case had, you know, impeccable reputation. They were very committed investigators, and they did a beautiful job in the Porter case. And they put together a very solid case that's withstood every legal proceeding. But aside from that, they were dragged through the mud for 7 years. And, you know, they were vilified in Chicago, and it hurt their families. And this happens to detectives time and time again in Chicago in cases where the offenders are very clearly guilty. And a lot of it has been through this media advocacy. So, of course, you know, I'm not too popular with them. So
I would. Yeah. You're not popular with the media. Yeah. But you're popular with the detectives. Did they stay on the job, these detectives, or were they booted off their job, demoted? What was some ramifications after this?
Well, they retired in 1990. They retired in 1998, and Porter was. They turned on the TV. They hadn't heard a word about this case. They turned on the TV, and there's Porter getting out of prison, running into the arms of a professor at Northwestern who spearheaded this thing called David Protest, who has since been, you know, has left the school under a huge scandal. At first they thought they got it wrong, and they sort of had a breakdown because they both were very religious guys, and they thought, we almost put an innocent man to death because Porter came within 2 hours of being executed. So that, but they couldn't understand, you know, where they went wrong. Everything seemed to add up. So they went back and painstakingly reviewed the case, and they saw what Northwestern was claiming, and they saw obviously that it was, Northwestern didn't even really look at the case at all before they started claiming somebody else did it.
Well, how did
they didn't even
this is also,
the witness.
Yeah. What's unusual about this case, too, is the fact that they then went ahead and prosecuted somebody else for the crime, because that's very unusual. Even when people are exonerated, you usually don't have another bite of the apple, so to speak. How did this other guy who you're claiming is really innocent wind up being arrested and convicted?
Well, after this guy, Elstory Simon, he confessed on tape to a private investigator who was working with Northwestern. And this confession is one of the most incredible events you're ever going to read about. He claims they came to his house early in the morning and said, we know you committed these crimes. The police are on their way to arrest you. This is a double homicide. You could get the death penalty. And he claims they engaged in this day-long intimidation process to get him to stay on tape. But what really has come to light in the last 6 months or so was the lead prosecutor on this case in 1999 just came out with an affidavit, and he said that when this tape came forward, this confession, he told the head of the lead prosecutor that he didn't think Porter should be released, and he didn't think that Simon should be arrested. He said he had grave doubts about the case, but the lead prosecutor went ahead and did it anyway. And one of the reasons he cites is that there was tremendous media pressure on the prosecutor's office in the Porter case and others, where they were claiming that all these guys were innocent and the prosecutor's office was out of control. And this prosecutor said this one affidavit said he bowed, you know, the head prosecutor bowed to political pressure and let him out or took the confession. Now, the confession is a crucial event, and it's really a time bomb that's going to have to be addressed by the county prosecutor. But it does shed a dark light on the prosecutor's office in 1999. But the wrongful conviction activists have been doing this for so long. They're very adept at intimidating prosecutors, police, the media, and anyone who questions them. They're quite brilliant and intense, fanatical about it. And I think this played a role in the Porter case. They're fervently anti. Go ahead.
But what is so glaring about this is that if they really believe that Porter was innocent, that's fine, and they try to get him out. But then to railroad somebody else is a travesty too, as you said. It's just a double travesty. I mean, that if that is true, that this guy was coerced, and we do know about these false confessions, and there are a lot of them, and there's a lot of study on this, so it is quite possible that it could have been a false confession on this other guy. He's been sitting in jail for what, 15-16 years now, is that right?
Yeah, and he's you know, after decades of Simon's lawyers and people, you know, trying to get the media and the prosecutor to look at this evidence, finally the state's attorney, especially after the prosecutor came forward in the affidavit and said, I didn't think Porter should be released, I didn't think Simon should be arrested, she took up the case under the Conviction Integrity Unit, which reviews convictions, and she's looking at it right now, but she hasn't made a decision yet. But you know, she's seen all this evidence.
Take another 5 years. See, this is what I'm talking about. They drag their feet on these things. It takes forever, and meanwhile, somebody's languishing in prison. I mean, if he is really innocent, this is a travesty that's even greater than the wrong guy getting out. I mean, it's horrible, if it's true.
Well, I believe it's true, and I think it'll hold up in court, and that's what I pinned my whole book on. And that's basically where the Porter case is at right now. There's a documentary film being made about the case, and there's also my book, and I've written a few articles about it. And so there's a momentum now that was never there before. So I think it's going to be hard for the prosecutor to ignore some of this evidence. I mean, one of the most amazing things about this confession that they got from Simon is they went to his house, and he resisted giving a confession. He said, well, I want a lawyer. And the private investigator who was trying to get the confession from him said, well, you want a lawyer? I'll get you a lawyer. And he calls up an associate of his from Chicago who drives up to Milwaukee. Now, I don't think I've ever heard in my life that of a guy who's accusing somebody of murder getting him an attorney. That's unbelievable. And an attorney who go ahead and encourages his client to confess to a crime, when there's seven witnesses who say that Porter did the murder. Now, what lawyer would tell their client to confess to a crime when there's seven witnesses who say somebody else did it? Of course, you would go to trial. Well, the first thing you would tell your client is, don't say a word to this guy. You have a right to remain silent.
Exactly.
And say, get him out of your apartment. Get him out of your apartment right now. And this lawyer didn't do that. So this confession is so full of anomalies and violations of due process that it's hard to believe that it made its way into a court. But this is Chicago, so.
Yeah, it's a shame. It really. Well, also, the other anomaly, as I said before, is the fact that usually when somebody is exonerated, they don't usually, you know, it's not like a TV show. The wrong person is usually going to go free. I mean, the actual criminals are going to probably go free, too, because they just don't usually wind up retrying the case. But as you said, I guess there was so much pressure to not only exonerate Porter, but also get somebody else for the crime to make it, quote-unquote, right. But by doing that, if they pick the wrong guy, it's just, you know, confounded the situation in a way that was more tragic.
Yeah, Yes, you have to put the Porter case in context too, because just prior to this, there had been several big cases where they had exonerated some people, and the wrongful conviction movement was fervently anti-death penalty, so I think there was this sense that, you know, if we can get a guy who's been sentenced to death, if we can get him off, we can destroy the death penalty. And that's exactly what happened with the Porter case. There was so much media hoopla over the case that the governor, citing this case as one of his main motives, ended the death penalty in Illinois. Whether you're for it or against it, you know, I'm generally against the death penalty. But this was the aim, was to end the death penalty.
Well, I'm against it for a number of reasons, and one of the reasons might be the fact that what if you had the wrong guy? But I'm against it on other principles as well. But it's a fascinating story, and you got hooked on it. I guess you just got obsessed with it, and that's how good writing comes out. You get obsessed with a story, and you got to keep working it. And you did that. What are you working on now? Do you have a new thing that you're cooking up?
Well, this book has become sort of a trilogy of books because it dovetails into another case in which a guy was exonerated from death row. He was convicted of setting a fire that killed 7 people and injured 17. 2 of the people who died were his own wife and son. And he was exonerated, and he was given $6 million in a settlement. And there's many, many detectives, many who worked the case, who passionately claim that there's no doubt this guy was guilty. And so I'm researching that case, and it ties into the Porter case in many levels. And so I'm writing a second book about that one.
Oh, interesting. But you don't know yet. Have you figured out whether you think he's guilty or not, or you definitely think he is or not?
I think there's very little doubt that he's guilty. But, I mean, I'll take a look at the evidence. I mean, I've read their claims that he's innocent. I've read what they cite as the evidence that he's innocent. And I've read a lot of stuff that shows very overwhelmingly that he's guilty. But, you know, one of the things that happens in the wrongful conviction movement is they take the cases out of the courtroom, where there's strict rules of evidence and rules of presenting things, into the media. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of nonsense gets thrown into it, all this rumor and innuendo and propaganda. And so this is a main tactic, and that's what they did in this case. Every legal proceeding that looked at this case, and there were dozens, and reviewed it, they all decided, yeah, this guy did it, no doubt about it, including, even the jury rule. It was a jury trial. So time and again, you'll see that the wrongful conviction movement waits about 10 to 20 years until the case is over. Mm-hmm. Witnesses have died. Detectives have retired. People don't remember things. The prosecutors are less enthused about trying a case so old and having to go over all the evidence. And then, you know, they find people in prison who suddenly out of nowhere make some wild claim that they didn't make before. For example, in the Porter case, Porter never once mentioned that he was coerced by the detectives ever, or torture, anything. And then 16 years later, right when his case goes to a civil trial and he realizes they're not going to settle, he makes this claim that the police tortured him, the detectives tortured him. Now, he never mentioned this when he was arrested, not in his appeals, anywhere. It was clearly a Hail Mary pass for the civil trial. But the irony of it was that the detectives never even met him in the course of their investigation. They only got a warrant for his arrest. And not one journalist, not one person in Chicago pointed out the simple fact, how do you torture somebody you've never met? So,
very interesting.
So these wrongful conviction activists, in so many of these cases, they wait 10 to 20 years when witnesses have died off, and particularly when victims have died.
Yeah.
When victims have died,
not as much.
They can't get on the stand and describe it again. So that's what I think happened in the Hobley case. But, you know, I'm going to sit down and talk to all these people who will talk to me and see if I can sort it out.
So you found your genre. You're like this true crime, you know, cold case kind of detective writing. That's your genre that you have fallen into or really created for yourself.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes really lament it because I never thought myself as being a crime writer or anything, but it's pulled me in and I can't get out of it. And it's kind
you can't
of
get
a,
out of
you
it,
know,
yeah.
I wish I could sometimes, but I can't.
Wish I could, but I can't. What are some of you, do you have influences, other writers that you admire that you've tried to emulate or you think have influenced you?
Yeah, the writers who most influenced me are the magical realist writers, William Kennedy and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and the American poet Walt Whitman. But you know, in writing about these murder cases, you know, I'm really coming into conflict with a lot of the magical realist writers because the magical realist writers are very tied to, especially the Latin American writers, and Marquez in particular, very tied to the Cuban Revolution. And Marquez was a very close friend of Castro's, and they're very much into the that political and social movement. And the wrongful conviction movement is very much tied to the 60s radicals, especially 1968, and the Weather Underground, the group that went around setting bombs off throughout the country. And, you know, I've moved an antagonist to those feelings. I'm not enamored of those movements. And so I think one of the reasons that these murder cases, they're all tied together in such compelling and ironic and incredible, fantastic ways that I really think they really point literature in a new direction, I think, for me anyway, and I'd like to push it a little bit. And really, I use these murders in one way. I like to look at them as to confront my own feelings about literature and meaning. And yeah. So it's throwing me
way?
In conflict.
What do you, in what well, way do you think it changes your way of the actual writing of it?
Well, for example, the magical realists, you know, one thing people would say about, you know, magical realism is that it uses the fantastic to reinforce reality, to explain reality better. And, right. You know, if you read Marquez's interviews, he talks about, he has this very slick and seductive way of talking how the magical exists in life, the fantastic exists. And Chicago is sort of the opposite of that. You know, to take a guy who was convicted of a double homicide like Porter, and Porter, if you look at Porter's rap sheet, he is as dark a predator as you're going to find. This guy was trouble. You ask anybody in the neighborhood where he grew up, everybody was afraid of him. And to take a guy like that and transform him into this folk hero, this victim, and to make him a hero, it is magical. However, it seems magical, but it's actually just a crime.
Yeah, well, it's black magic. It's using magic in the darker
right.
side of it. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been reading up in the late 60s about, you know, the Cuban Revolution. And, you know, I think that a lot of the American left romanticized it and, you know, romanticizes a lot of I think in America we've taken a lot of romanticized crime quite a bit and taken it away from what it is. And refuse to look at it for what it is. And I think part of it is tied to the, you know, since the late 60s and the literary movement has been part of it. And I believed it for a long time, too, but now I'm sort of confronting my doubt about it. But I'm, you know, hoping not to become an ideologue or, you know, I don't want to look at the world through a, you know, ideology, but so my doubt is guiding me in these books,
and you carve out your own voice, and you carve out your own genre, really. So it's got that grit to it. People like good detective stories, true crime stories, all of those things. I think they'll find it certainly in your latest book, Crooked City. And you can find out more at your website. Is it crookedcity.org? Is that where we go for that?
Yes.
CircuitCity.org. Martin Priebus, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us. I wish you the best. You got a lot of passion for sure in talking about your subject and in your writing as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. It's a pleasure. Take care. That's Martin Priebus. Find out more at CircuitCity.org. It's the Amy Beth Erkowitz Show. Let's see. The music starting to work. Reach out. Via Twitter, AB Writes, on the phone line 347-857-4505.
Make any difference, it can't be important. something might be around soon. I remember she had satellite radio. I guess she seemed a bit nervous. Do you think I'm that stupid? Well, what the hell, I'll tell the story again. In far light, she looks alright. In the daylight, she was desperate. That's the right, I was desperate too. I'm getting pretty sick of this interview.
And the Heart and the Stones with their epic street story, Heartbreaker. Thanks again, going out to Martin Freed. Find out more about his fascinating book of connected true crime essays, Crooked City, at crookedcity.org. And on the Twitter feed, getting some response already. Roy says, fascinating, could make a good movie. Yeah, I think so. Wonder who he'd like to play him if he's in it. Maybe he wouldn't be in it. I don't know. And Tanya says, interesting, but I think the guy has a police agenda. Well, that's true. I think he kind of does, although he says he tries not to be an ideologue. Kind of hard not to see it from your own prism, but it's still fascinating reading, and you can, of course, be skeptical at certain points. I mean, I happen to think the Innocence Project does some good work, but maybe they screwed up on this one. I don't know. But it's very unusual, I do know this, to have another person get convicted even if someone's exonerated. So if this other guy is languishing in prison and he's really innocent, that is a shame, for sure. Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes or on the studio line 347-857-4505 while we are still in the justice realm. And again, I have this deal with my mouth that has to work at least until 1:32 o'clock. Okay. Michael Dunn is back on trial. The guy in Florida in the so-called loud music case, remember, he was convicted of 3 counts, I believe, of attempted murder. But the kid that he actually killed, Jordan Davis, they hung on that one, and they're retrying him for that murder case. And a lot of people would say, well, why bother doing it? Because he's going to serve probably close to the rest of his life in prison on all those charges as is. But it's important to the family, and it's important to justice. And it's probably important to these prosecutors because it's the same office that tried to prosecute or did prosecute George Zimmerman and was unsuccessful. So we'll see what happens. Jury selection, I think, started yesterday in that case. Next week, a couple of big cases, or high-profile cases anyway, coming to the fore. Jodi Arias, the retrial in the penalty phase gets underway. And just in time, she's auctioning off, get this, the glasses that she wore at the first trial. Now, it's not supposedly for money for her defense. There is a place where you can go give money for her defense, too, if you're so inclined. But she claims she's giving it to charity. The only trouble is she hasn't identified the so-called undisclosed Phoenix charity. So she's back in the news. She was going to represent herself. Now she's not. I don't know. If it comes off when it's supposed to come off, it's set to start at least jury selection next Monday. And she wants the cameras out of the courtroom. This is the chick that was courting the cameras back then, if you remember. We'll see what happens. And the Giudicis, the infamous New Jersey reality show couple, Teresa and Joe Giudici, finally will face the music. Allegedly, they've had this pushed up a couple of times. I think next Thursday, October 2nd, is the date for sentencing. And I hear tell that Juicy Joe may be getting another break thrown in. They already got their 41 counts knocked down to 4. But he has a local state charge in New Jersey for falsifying identification on a driver's license, which he could have faced 10 years. That sentencing will take place in October 15th, and supposedly they say he'll probably do it concurrently, so they'll just fold it in and let him do his federal time, and then maybe he may or may not face deportation. I'm going to say he doesn't. Teresa will probably get house arrest, at least that's what people think. I'm not so sure what she deserves, but I think next week we're going to replay the interview I did with her now crisis manager Wendy Feldman. Remember Wendy? She claimed she would never work with them, and the interview was quite fascinating. It went viral all over the internet when somebody dug it up some months back. She kind of squelched it. Unfollowed me on Twitter. She's mad at me. I don't know why. She's the one that said the thing she said. I am much more generous to Teresa than she is in the interview, which is what makes it kind of amusing. So we're going to dig that out and post it for you next week. So that's what's happening in the Justice Stories. Anything you want to weigh in on, by all means, do so at AB Writes or at the studio line, 347-857-4505, if you are indeed listening live. People need. You're in trouble with the law? Call someone. We'll send lawyers, guns, and money. Here's the great late Warren Zevon. robbery. Joni Mitchell warns Yvonne, too, with Lawyers, Guns, and Money as we button up our justice segment on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Checking out the Twitter feed, a couple of 40 regulars checking in. Shay says, loving the show. Like how you work the music for the subject. Yeah, we do that. We try. And Johnny Fever's Hangover, like the show as usual, AB. Got to check out early, but we'll catch the rest on podcast. All right. You can do that, too, if you miss a show or want to hear it again. They're all archived for on-demand listening at the Blog Talk Radio site. Follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show there. Download episodes at iTunes, NetNow, or at the website, amybetharkowitz.com. That's also the place to go should you want to be a guest on the show. We're always looking for compelling storytellers, from filmmakers to musicians, authors to theater folks, social commentators. Tell us about your story. We'll see about getting you on the show. Got some great stuff coming up in the offing, too, so join us there, won't you? Also, the place for the Inspiration to Action Challenge, some shout-outs to offer today to Petra in, I think it's Rhode Island. I'm not sure the city. She says she's working on a dance project. This is the first dancer I think we've had chime in. She says, you know, I work in movement, but journaling helps me focus and process my feelings. You got me back doing it. And it's working, so thanks. Well, thank you, Petra. I'm glad it is working, and congratulations on the dance project. Hope it goes well. Keep us posted. If it's working for you, I'd love to hear from you. We'd love to give you a shout-out. Reach out to the website, amybetharkowitz.com. On the other hand, if you need some cajoling in that department, we can start a creative conversation for coaching and counseling questions. The first one is always on me, and you can also find out more about the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, both Killing Time and Dead Silent. My books are available for ebook and paperback, and I wish someone would ban them already, because I think sales would go up. Yeah, it's National Ban Books Week. It's the 32nd annual, started by the American Library Association, a.k.a. the ALA, and it's pretty tough stuff, because it's interesting why books are banned, and some books, famous books, have been banned over the years for crazy reasons, if you think about it. In 2013, now, they claim that the main reasons people, the challenges are due to sexual explicit material, offensive language. A lot of people claim it's unsuited for a particular age group, violence, and homosexuality. Got 361 challenges from the years 2000 to 2009. The top books in 2013 that were banned, Captain Underpants, the series by Dav Pilkey, they claimed offensive language and unsuited for age group and violence. The Bluest Eye, can you believe Toni Morrison? What a beautiful book that is. Offensive language, sexually explicit material, and not suitable for age group, and violence were cited as reasons for that. The biggest one they said last year, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie. Drugs, alcohol, and smoking, offensive language, racism, sexually explicit, and age group issues. 50 Shades of Grey. Well, yeah, I think that one probably is, at least in school, offensive. I don't know about it. Banning it in the library, people can read what they want, but probably no merit for kids reading 50 Shades of Grey. The Hunger Games, A Bad Boy Can Be Good for a Girl by Tanya Lee Stone. Looking for Alaska by John Green. The Perks of Being a Wallflower, that great book by Stephen Chbosky. Bless Me, Ultima, and Bone, a series by Jeff Smith for reasons of political viewpoint, racism, and violence. So there you have it. If you ban them, though, these books will sell. But over the years, books like To Kill a Mockingbird, The Grapes of Wrath, The Diary of Anne Frank, Catcher in the Rye have all been banned. And a lot of teachers, you know, live on the edge. Teachers sometimes get a lot of flack, but they want to teach these books because they do have value and they want people to be encouraged to read. And you can handle this material. We read Catcher in the Rye. We read a lot of these books. Diary of Anne Frank, all those books I think were read. I don't think they were banned back then, but a lot of books, people become hypersensitive, hyper-aware of different things, and I think parents and parents' groups should be involved. No question about that, and chime in, but sometimes a little controversy is okay. Question is, of course, how far do you want to go, right? that's always the way. But in any event, it is Banned Books Week, so do yourself a favor. Read a banned book. Buy a banned book and give it away to someone and introduce kids to reading. Reading can be subversive, and that subversive nature can get kids into it. You know, if you think it's something, oh, this is not what we're supposed to do, that can get kids really excited about reading. And whatever works, I think, is a good thing. Even reading racy things sometimes. Just let them read. Let them read. Get introduced to something, as they say. Somebody who will introduce you to reading via his songs is celebrating a birthday today. Yeah, Bruce Springsteen is 65. He can collect Social Security. Can you believe it? Man, that man is still so energetic. He still looks so great. He's in great shape. His voice is terrific. He's 65 years old today. Happy birthday, Bruce Springsteen. He has so many characters in his stories. I mean, he tells, in his songs, he tells stories in all his songs. And I think that for someone who's interested in literature and writing as a kid, he kind of sparked my interest in writing stories because he had so many colorful characters. Here's an old one. Incident on 57th Street. It's the Boss. Happy birthday, Bruce Springsteen. And the Andy Bithar cliche.
All of the switchblade knives.
and they kissed each other bye-bye. Now Johnny sat on the fire escape, watching the kids playing down in the street. And he called down, "Hey, little hero, summer's long, but I guess it ain't so sweet around here no more." Jenny sleeps in sheets damp with sweat. Johnny sits up all night and watches her dreaming on. And his sister breaks down in the chapel late at night after everybody's gone. Janie wakes up and moves over to share a pillow when she sees Johnny up and out of bed and putting his clothes on. And she sighs, them romantic young boys, all they ever want to do is sweat. Them romantic young boys, they call the window, "Hey Johnny, why don't you come on out and make a little easy money tonight?" And Johnny sighed, "Good night, it's all tight, Jane. I swear I'll meet you tomorrow night on Lover's Lane. We may find it out on the street tonight, baby. Or we may walk until the morning light, maybe." Oh, 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 yeah, oh, 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 oh,
oh. Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Dark blue.
keep it close to my heart. You see the light shining in my breath, leading me through the dark. 7 days, seven candles in my window, lighting your way. Your favorite records on the turntable, I drop the needle and pray.
It's a great one from Bruce Springsteen's The Rising, and way back where it all started, from The Wild, The Innocent, and the E Street Shuffle incident on 57th Street. All those images of Spanish Johnny and Jane can work wonders on illiterate kids. So thank you, Bruce Springsteen, and happy birthday. You worked hard for those 65 candles on your cake. Long may you run, indeed. Twitter seen a lot of folks chiming in. Dondi says, loving the Springsteen. Hope you have a few more up your sleeve. I have a couple. We'll see if we can get them in. We have time, we will. And Royal checking in, a newbie, says, like the way you work the commentary with the music. It's a great show. You have a gift. Well, thank you so much. It's a gift to have you here, Royal. Happy to have you aboard. Nixie chiming in says, love the Springsteen. Thanks again, AB. All right, well, thank you. On a sadder note, I want to mention the passing of another Hollywood star. Polly Bergen passed away over the weekend at the age of 84. She is an actress, singer, who won an Emmy Award in 1958 for her portrayal of the alcoholic torch singer Helen Morgan, and was nominated 50 years later for her role on Desperate Housewives. So she had a pretty good long-standing career. Highlights included a chilling turn as the menace wife of lawyer Gregory Peck, stalked by the psychopath Robert Mitchum in the original 1962 film Cape Fear. She was a panelist for 5 years in the CBS game show To Tell the Truth, and she got a Tony nomination for her performance as a gritty former showgirl in the 2001 revival of Stephen Sondheim's musical Follies. She started her career as a teenager singing hillbilly songs on the radio, believe it or not, and quickly found roles in movies. Her early credits include the 1949 Western Across the Rio Grande, in which she portrayed a saloon singer. She also did 3 films in which she appeared with the comedy team of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. Her Broadway debut was made in 1953 in the revue John Murray Anderson's Almanac. The cast featured Hermione Gingold, Billy DeWolf, and Harry Belafonte. She wanted to make an impression as a vocalist, but she overexerted herself. She injured her throat and had to leave show business for a while to undergo surgery. She has admitted that she was less than thrilled with the quality of movies that she was offered as a contract player, but she had some standouts. Besides Cape Fear, there was also The Caretakers. That's a really interesting movie, early 60s, 63, I think. They show it on TCM sometimes. She convincingly played an inmate in a mental hospital ruled by a dictatorial nurse, played by Joan Crawford. Haven't seen it. Check it out. It's worth it. And she also had some light comedies under her belt, like Move Over, Darling. That was a fun one with Doris Day and James Garner. And Kisses for My President in 1964, in which she starred as the nation's first female president. Intriguing, isn't it? And, of course, in later years, Sopranos fans will remember her as Fran Feldstein, the former mistress of Tony Soprano's dad. An interesting role indeed. Polly Bergen passed away at the age of 84. And I do want to mention also yesterday was the fourth anniversary of the tragic suicide death of Tyler Clementi. Remember the young Rutgers student who was humiliated so much by his roommate and their friends with the webcam that he took his own life. Very, very sad story. But yesterday the Tyler Clementi Foundation, the parents started this foundation to eradicate homophobia and bullying. The father posted a very poignant posting. He says, it's 4 years ago today that Tyler took his life. Again, a day very unlike that stormy, rainy day in 2010. Today here in North Jersey, it's clear and sunny. During this past year, the foundation has grown. We now have our first full-time executive director and have expanded our board of trustees to 11 members. I want to thank you for your support. Without it, we would not be here. I heard in the news that the New York, New Jersey Port Authority will include a system that will make it impossible to jump off the GW Bridge as part of future construction work, and I applaud that decision. The family is very active, and we are going on. Some days, of course, are better than others. I believe that things are getting better in society as a whole. However, on an individual basis, people get bullied all the time. That's why you need your friends. Remember to not be afraid to seek help if you need it, and to be upstanders and good to your friends. Thanks for your support. God bless you all. Joe Clementi. My heart goes out to that man and his family. Indeed, what happened to Tyler Clementi was a tragedy, and we do still see bullying, and we do still see shaming, but we also do see people getting up and standing up against it in greater numbers, and you have to do it on an individual basis. Be kind to someone. Hug your friends. Reach out. Every small gesture may seem like it's insignificant to you, but it may mean so much to someone, and it may, in fact, save a life. So please reach out. And God bless you, the Tyler Clementi family, and the work they're trying to do now with the Tyler Clementi Foundation. It is the Annie Beth Arkwright Show. A few minutes left. We'll squeeze in another song or two from one of New Jersey's favorite sons, Bruce Springsteen. Before we get out of here, I want to tell you, I think Friday we may be off. Not sure. We may have a pop-up coffee clutch. We'll post it on social media if we do. But certainly coming up on Tuesday, we are going to meet the gals, Heather and Andrea, behind Barbara Jean Coast, that fabulous 50s butterfly, social butterfly, gadfly, and author of the Poppy Cove Mysteries, the latest of which, Death of a Beauty Queen, is now out, and it's a fun book. We'll talk about influences, inspirations, how they control Barbara Jean. That's part of the deal. And we'll spin some tunes from that fabulous 50s era, so if you have a favorite, email us or tweet me your favorite Fabulous 50 tunes with the hashtag Fabulous 50s, and we'll see if we can get it on for you coming up next Monday. The usual hoopla, of course, free flow pop culture convo, inspiration to action shout-outs. I think we'll unveil another motivational jumpstart in our quest to start anew, creatively speaking, that is. That's all coming up on Tuesday. In the meantime, don't forget to follow the Amy Beth Arkwright Show at the Blog Talk Radio site, download episodes at iTunes, NetNow, and friend me on Facebook. We'll hook you up with their Radio Graffiti update page, 24/7 at Twitter, at AB Writes. Thanks again going out to Martin Preeb. Fascinating book, Crooked City. Find out more at his website, crookedcity.org. And thanks, of course, to all the great tweets. Always appreciate it. Love to fun. It's always fun to play with you guys in real time. I know we get lots more listeners on podcasts, but if you are listening live, it's fun to get you in the mix. And I want to thank our party TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora, in the booth. A couple of glitches early on, but we got through. And ML at headquarters, we're going for it. The final six games, can the Mets pull to 500? I think they can. There's always promise out there. Happy birthday again to Bruce Springsteen. Have yourself a great week, whatever you do, wherever you go. Ride safe, play nice, dream big. Hey, come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkwright Show. Take care now.
gotta look hard. Wounded deep in battle, I stand stuck like some soldier undaunted. To her gesture, smile, I'll stand on fire. She's all I ever wanted. Oh, but to let your blue walls get in the way of these snacks, how to get your carpet baggers off my back. You wouldn't even give me time to cover my tracks. You said, here's your mirror and your ball and jacks, but they're not what I came for, and I'm sure you see that too. I came for you, for you. I came for you, but you did not need my urgency. I came for you. And your cloud liners for my electric third degree. We're crawling to my ambulance. Your pulse is getting weak. Oh, be yourself on now to me, girl, while you got the strength to speak. Cause they're waiting for you at Bellevue with their oxygen masks. But I give it all to you now, if only you could ask. Oh, and don't call for your surgeon, even he says it's too late. It's not your lungs this time, it's your heart that holds your feet. Don't give me my money, honey, I don't want it back. You and your phony face and your Union Jack. We'll take a local joker and teach him how to act. I swear I was never that way, even when I really cracked.
Out on the floor, cause I've broken all your windows and I've ran through all your doors.